Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, one and all, and welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio. What we need to do very first off is get the legal goo out of the way. Do remember, opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. Trisha's True Crime Radio is a completely separate entity from WebSleuth.com and ForumsForJustice.org. In other words, my friends, if you get upset at something you hear on Trisha's True Crime Radio, you come to moi personally. Don't take it out on any of the forums. And Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by your local no-kill animal shelter. Go to www.nokillnetwork.org and find your local no-kill shelter. You could do something as easy as volunteering an hour a week to help out. That's www.nokillnetwork.org. Later in the show, we are going to welcome Chris Stover. He is an anchor reporter for WCAV, WVAW, and WHAU, and we'll be talking about Randy Allen Taylor. Is he a serial killer or isn't he? And Chris has been following that case since the very beginning and has some very interesting things to report to us. Levi Page joins us as well. Don't forget to go to levipageshow.com. But first, I want to welcome a man that is incredibly amazing. This doctor is going to explain DNA to us to the point we will not wonder anymore, my friends. His name is Dr. Dan Crane, and Dan Crane graduated with a bachelor's degree for a double major in biology and chemistry from John Carroll University in 1985 and a PhD in molecular biology from Penn State University in 1990. Dr. Crane has been the president and CEO of Forensic Bioinformatics, Inc. since 2002. Dr. Crane is a court-recognized expert witness and has appeared in the capacity in some 90 criminal proceedings since 1991. He's testified in 22 different states, 3 federal courts, 3 court martials, as well as in the countries of Australia, Northern Ireland, and England. He is also a professor at Wright State University since 2007. You can find out a full description. I haven't even begun to touch the background of Dr. Grant Dan Crane. You can go to bioforensics.com to find out about that. Okay, here's the deal. We're going to learn about DNA tonight. Now, just because DNA of a person is found at a crime scene doesn't mean the person is guilty of a crime, or does it? Do juries now expect to have DNA in the case or they won't convict? And maybe, just maybe tonight, we'll find out why my brain does a complete freeze at the mere thought of trying to understand this thing we call DNA. Dr. Crane, welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Trisha. I think I just want to sit back and listen to you talk about me more. It's been great.
Well, thank you. I'll tell you what, once I start talking about DNA, your eyes will start spinning back in your head because I think I know it, and then I realize I have no clue. And what I'm excited about tonight is you explain how DNA works in such a normal fashion that even people like me are going to be able to understand it. But just in case, in fact, it would be a fact that if I tried and ask you questions, I think I would mess everything up. So I've brought on probably the second smartest person next to you, Dr. Crane, and that is our friend Cynic. And Cynic is our local DNA expert. Cynic, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. And Levi Page, are you here with us, my friend?
I'm here. Hi.
Oh, hi. And let's see, we're still waiting for Michael in Minnesota to call in. He is my unofficial co-host. And Levi, if you have a question, please jump in. If I have a question, I'll jump in. But I'm going to turn it over to Cynic now, because Cynic is going to make this show sound incredibly intelligent by the questions that he is going to play. I know, that is actually kind of funny when you think about it. He's going to give the questions to Dr. Crane about the DNA and help us understand more about this complex science that seems to just have a shroud over every single criminal case to date. And Cynic, the floor is yours, my friend.
Thank you, Trisha. And just to be clear, in terms of being the second smartest, that's a very, very, very distant second. But Dr. Crane, I'm so glad that you graciously agreed to lend us an hour of your time. It actually is a thrill for me. Thank you, and welcome to the show.
I'm happy to help.
I'll get right to things because our time is fairly short. One of the areas which you and others at Bioforensics have centered on is with regards to the perils of considering forensic DNA evidence as this perfect forensic evidence. To a general public who's been feeding on a steady television diet of CSI, has grown to be an expectation of DNA evidence. When that evidence is absent, I've heard jurors express dissatisfaction and a feeling that the case just simply hasn't been proven. What would you say is the chief reason that people should be cautious when considering DNA evidence?
Well, I think part of the problem is just what has to happen in a TV show. Everything has to be neatly resolved in the span of 30 or 60 minutes, and it's also very common for TV shows to paint people very unambiguously as heroes or villains. And I think what that ends up translating to is just kind of giving you the bottom line of what's going on with the DNA tests without actually fostering an understanding of what's really taking place. I think one thing that the general public doesn't appreciate that I just wish there was a way that we could get everybody to understand, and shows like this I think are a step in the right direction, is just this one sort of axiom, and that is that the presence of a DNA profile on an evidence sample doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the time frame or the circumstances under which that DNA came to be there. We really need to look to other types of investigations, blood spatter analysis, video captures of what was going on during the crime, confessions, to be able to get that piece of the puzzle, because the DNA profile just tells us that the person's DNA was there. How it is that it got there is still something that needs to be sorted out, and I don't think the TV shows have been very good at conveying that subtle but axiomatically important aspect of DNA profiling.
I'm glad you mentioned the word puzzle, because I think in a lot of cases jurors expect DNA to be essentially the only piece of the puzzle. They're not comfortable with the fact that it's just simply one piece of a puzzle that makes a circumstantial case or a case presented in trial.
Absolutely. It was just earlier today I've been helping a solicitor in England, participating in some activities in Oxford in England, where the whole issue in his case was an individual raped or was consensual sex involved? And he was very worried about the DNA testing results because the conclusions of the DNA test was that it was a 1 in a billion chance that somebody other than the defendant was the contributor of the DNA to a sample that was collected. And it took me a while, but I think I've been able to impress upon him that these DNA tests really do nothing in terms of telling us which is more likely, rape or consensual sex.
Can I jump in here for
sure.
I'm sorry, I apologize. There's a great question here, and it piggybacks to what you're explaining. As you said, Dr. Crane, and Cynic, please forgive me. Remember, I'm kind of the dumber half, so you have to be nice to me. Be gentle. when talking about a rape case, you're right. DNA won't be able to tell if it's consensual or not. What about this? Is there any way to tell how long DNA has been there, or does it depend on the sample itself?
In very contrived circumstances, you can have the DNA tell you something about how long it's been there. And the sort of contrivances that you need are to have the DNA encapsulated in a newspaper, for instance, so that you know that the DNA couldn't have gotten there before the newspaper was printed. But the actual DNA profile itself doesn't look that different in most circumstances for a sample that's 1 day old as opposed to 1 month old or even 1 year and sometimes even a decade old. I've seen DNA profiles that have been generated off of mailbags that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid bled on over 100 years ago.
Whoa, really?
And those DNA profiles look for all the world like a DNA profile you would have gotten off of a sample that was just a few days old.
So let me give you a hypothetical. Let's say somebody is charged with killing his girlfriend and his DNA is all over the knife. There's no way to tell if he used it to chop up an apple, right?
Right.
I mean, that's right. Yeah, so that So DNA, all DNA does is establish that the person had contact with that particular object at some point, correct?
Right, exactly, exactly.
Okay. And I'm sorry, Dan, I didn't mean to, or Cynic, I didn't mean to interrupt. Please continue.
Thanks, Tricia. It's not an interruption. Those are good questions. Before we get to some more cases and some more hypotheticals, I guess we're going to have to get over a couple of potentially, well, what are probably some people consider boring things, but it helps us to speak about DNA. And so I'm going to give you some terms. I'm just going to ask you to briefly define them. They're in no particular order. Nanogram, picogram, electrophorogram, it's a lot of grams, allele, locus, and marker. Just a brief overview.
All right. Well, if I miss one or two of them, make sure you remind me and I'll come back. Maybe I should put a little asterisk here. My day job is as I am a biology professor. I teach introductory freshman biology among a number of other things at Wright State. And so I find that remarkably, studies have shown that in an introductory level biology class, a student will learn more vocabulary words than they will in the entire first year of a foreign language class at the college level. So you've hit on some of that with the words that you're touching on here. Let's get those grams out of the way first, though. I think pretty much everybody is familiar with the idea of a gram. A packet of sugar that you might get at a restaurant is typically about a gram to 2 grams of sugar. It's just a measure of weight. We need often to talk about smaller quantities than a gram, though, and especially when we're talking about DNA testing. And so let me go through the scale for you here. If you have a thousandth of a gram, more or less 1 grain of sugar from that packet of sugar, we'll call that a milligram. If you have a thousandth of that thousandth or a millionth of a gram, we'll be calling that a microgram. And then if you break that thousandth of a thousandth down to 1,000th part still, now we're talking about a billionth of a gram. Those are nanograms, one of the words that you mentioned earlier. And smaller still, if you want to talk about a trillionth of a gram, a thousandth of a thousandth of a thousandth of a thousandth of a bag of sugar, that is a picogram. So the short answer to your initial question, a nanogram is a billionth of a gram, a picogram is a trillionth of a gram. And maybe it helps now if I put that into some context. Why do we bother talking about such small things? We do that, well, first of all, because our bodies, yours and mine, are made of trillions of cells, typically 2 or 3 trillion cells for a human body. And each one of those trillion cells, there's some interesting exceptions, but for the most part, every one of those cells has a perfect copy of our DNA, and that DNA in each of our cells weighs, get this, 6.5 picograms, or 6.5 trillionths of a gram. And so when we want to talk about DNA testing, we need to start talking about, well, what's the minimum amount of DNA you need in order to be able to get a test result? And the answer to that question, at least theoretically, is you need at least one cell, which means you need 6.5 trillionths of a gram of DNA. Now, in practice, we don't get particularly reliable or good results from a single cell. It can be done, but there's some questions that arise. And so in practice, labs will typically shoot for on the order of 100 to 200 cells such that they get about a nanogram or a billionth of a gram of DNA. And so if you think back to what I was suggesting with respect to the packet of sugar, again, you know, my eyes are probably not that much worse than yours, and I'm telling you, I have a hard time seeing a single grain of sugar. We're not talking, though, about a single grain of sugar. We're talking about a thousandth of a thousandth of a thousandth of a grain of sugar, vanishingly small amounts of material. All right?
Wow.
So there you go. So that's 2 of your grams taken care of.
Damn, that's tiny.
Should we
That's
pause?
Some tiny stuff.
Or do you want me to go through more of the words on your list?
Actually, we do have a question. If we could, if
okay.
we could take that question, Michael, go right ahead. What's your question, my dear?
Well, it piggybacks back on what your question was, Tricia, about DNA. We can't learn the time that the sample was present, but the tech who draws or creates the sample can tell, for example, if it's fresh blood, dried blood, and in your example of the money bag that Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid bled all over, that blood obviously would have a completely different look being 100-plus years old. So the tech can visually describe more about that DNA sample than the actual DNA test. Am I correct?
Let me give you a qualified yes, because yes, entirely, in the sense that the DNA is silent on that. It really can't tell if a sample is 100 years old or a few days old. And then yes, also in the sense that we really need to look to other things to give us insights in terms of how and when and why DNA came to be associated with a sample. Among those other things are things like blood spatter analysis, and there are serological tests that can be done to look for the presence or absence of proteins. Proteins don't persist for hundreds of years the way that DNA might, so that might be a clue for you. But I make it a qualified yes, because there's a qualitative difference between the kind of results we get from DNA tests and these other investigative approaches. And so you've touched on it yourself by saying that, you know, from the look of it, that's a very subjective, it has the potential to be a very subjective interpretation. And so, you know, we can start building a case and start making sort of a more complete story by tying into these other things, but in terms of the reliability of the conclusions, DNA really does set the gold standard.
Right, right. I can understand that. Thank you.
Okay, Doctor, let's continue on with the description that Dan, or the, excuse me, I'm getting Dan and Cynic mixed up here. Cynic gave us the names of the weights, the measurements. Let's continue with those, okay? Because now I'm still trying to wrap my head around the thousandths of a thousandth of a thousandth. So,
that's
anyway,
when words like brilliant come in handy.
Yes, exactly. So, anyway,
right.
Dan, what were the other numbers? Or other
we're down to the last gram, the electrophorogram,
okay.
Although it's not weight.
All right. Well, an electrophorogram has nothing at all to do with weight. And instead, an electrophorogram is essentially a graph that comes off of an instrument that we use when we're generating DNA profiles. And it's a graph that where there's a series of peaks and valleys, and the peaks correspond to fragments of DNA. And each individual, when you look at enough of these different parts of our DNA, you start to be able to say, that particular peak is one that's of a certain size that corresponds to a size fragment that we got from this individual. And when you start to do that across 9, 13, 20 different locations, you start to be able to say, we see a DNA profile, and we can start talking about whether or not those patterns of peaks on an electrophorogram match. If they do, we start talking about what's the chance that that would be a coincidence, what's the chance that two randomly chosen unrelated people would have the same pattern of peaks on an electrophorogram. And if they don't, we say that that individual is excluded as a possible source of the DNA that we've been looking at, and exclusions are absolute. There's no need to attach a statistic when you have an exclusion.
Hello.
Okay. In terms of hello, Don, Dr. Crane.
We're here.
Okay. Down quickly to the last three: allele,
great,
locus, and marker.
Great. So I tried to avoid the jargon with that last answer about an electrophorogram, but the peaks themselves, we call those peaks, actually the DNA that gives rise to them, we call those alleles. and the location, the specific spot on a chromosome that we're looking at is called a locus. So at any given locus, you may find two different alleles, one that you get from your mother and one that you get from your father. Locus is a Latin word, and is with a tip of the hat to our Latin forebears. And when we talk about more than one locus, we talk about loci. Curiously, I think that's an American butchering of the Latin. I think if you were proper Latin, it would be loci, but we pronounce it loci here in the U.S. And a marker is more or less the same as an allele. When we're talking about what markers you see, what alleles you see, those words could be used roughly interchangeably in that context.
Okay, I guess I found an easy way to remember locus is basically location, because it is referred to location on the chromosome.
But, exactly, yeah. It has the same Latin root.
Yes, exactly.
Location and locus, they're related.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Crane. Now that we've gotten some of the jargon out of the way, we can go on and perhaps discuss more meaningfully some cases and some hypotheticals with respect to DNA.
Sure.
Given that we're talking with such given that we're talking about such extremely small molecular material, what are the different ways that DNA can end up on a surface? Let's just pick something. Let's pick a doorknob. What are the different ways in terms of transfer? There are some nice terms that you can use here too, beginning with primary transfer.
Sure.
What are the different ways that DNA can end up on this doorknob?
Primary transfer is a very good place to start. Primary transfer is what we're talking about happening when an individual directly contacts an object. So I could get my DNA on a doorknob very easily by touching the doorknob. Let me put this in the context of the weights that we had been talking about earlier. I said that you need, theoretically, at least a single cell. In practice, more like 1 to 200 cells to get a DNA profile. Our bodies are made of trillions of cells. We shed tens of thousands of cells every day without giving it any thought or even noticing that it's happened. A typical fingerprint that anybody might leave behind has about 100 cells associated with it. So the same amount of pressure and interaction that you might need to have with a doorknob that would leave a fingerprint on that doorknob is sufficient to give rise to enough DNA for us to be able to generate a DNA profile. And I think you can boil that down very simply to this. If an individual has touched an object, there's at least the potential for us to be able to determine that through the process of DNA testing. So that's primary transfer. Secondary transfer, as you might be able to figure out just from the name itself, is the sort of thing that happens when my DNA ends up on the doorknob, not because I've touched the doorknob, but rather perhaps because I have shaken the hand of somebody else who goes and touches the doorknob. When that sort of DNA transfer happens, when my DNA gets on the doorknob through that type of intermediary, we say that secondary transfer has happened. And I think you can see how all the rest will play out at that point. Tertiary transfer involves my shaking somebody's hand, they're shaking somebody else's hand, and then that person touching the doorknob. So,
well, Dr. Crane, if I could jump in here, please. To me, this sounds very frightening, because I shake the hand of somebody who shakes the hand of somebody who goes in and murders somebody, and they find my DNA on that doorknob, and I've never even come close to that area. How do they tell if it's tertiary, if it's secondary? How in the world can you tell the difference? Because DNA is DNA, right?
It is. It is. And the DNA tests, at least as they are today, are simply not capable of discerning between primary, secondary, or tertiary transfer. The best that you might be able to do is look at the relative amounts of DNA that you find, but there have been a number of studies published in the scientific literature that show that sometimes the person whose DNA was transferred in a secondary fashion actually is the only one whose DNA shows up on an object, not the primary person whose hand they had shaken. So that's a very dangerous proposition. And again, it just comes back to that axiom that I mentioned to you at the beginning here. The presence of a DNA profile says nothing about the time frame or the circumstances under which the DNA got there.
So is that touch DNA, is tertiary DNA touch DNA? That's been the new hot buzzword. Is that the same thing?
In some sense, it is. Maybe before we talk about touch DNA, I should tell you about something else that precedes touch DNA in terms of the way that DNA profiling has evolved over the last few years. There's this idea of low copy number DNA or low template DNA that has really gotten beaten up fairly badly in some fairly prominent court cases. There was one, by many accounts, the biggest case in the history of the United Kingdom where an individual was charged with 56 counts that would each have brought a life prison sentence with him, with a conviction. The evidence that was brought against this individual was largely low copy number DNA testing. And it ended up that the individual got acquitted of all 56 counts when serious questions were raised about low copy number testing. Such serious questions and such a big deal was this acquittal that the United Kingdom put a moratorium on low copy number DNA testing for 6 months while they sorted out their house and then started to try to use it again. Because of that backlash against this very out-in-front kind of DNA testing where they're trying really hard and going to great lengths to get information from increasingly small amounts of material, less than 100 cells, maybe down in the 1 or 2 or 3 cell range, because of the backlash, a lot of other folks who were thinking it would be nice to be able to get DNA results from such tiny amounts of DNA felt that it would behoove them to not say that they were doing low copy number DNA testing. They started to talk about using low template testing. It wasn't too hard for it to be shown that low template testing and low copy number testing were one and the same. And now we're at the state where some laboratories are starting to talk about not having done low copy number or low template testing, but rather touch DNA testing.
Evolved. That's what it's evolved into, is touch DNA. But don't you think touch DNA is, and Cynic, I apologize. You're supposed to be asking the questions, but I'm the big dumb host, so I have to jump in here. Isn't touch DNA... To me, it's almost like false DNA because it gives a false impression that somebody was at a crime scene when in reality the markers or the sample is so minute that it doesn't matter. It could fly in there literally.
Yes.
Am I wrong?
No, yes. And so I think the thing is touch DNA test results are not necessarily bad. But they have to be taken they have to be interpreted with an enormous amount of caution, and it really needs to be done in a way where there's a very clear understanding of the sorts of things you've just been touching on, that this is a vanishingly small amount of DNA, and we need to have some really serious concerns about the tissue source. It's not possible to say if it came from blood or from semen or from saliva. And we have to be also aware that there's a much greater flexibility of interpretation of the test results when you're dealing with such small amounts of material. And that flexibility of interpretation ultimately should translate into much lower statistical weight being attached. And so there's a tendency, I think, for jurors and people in the public to simply hear DNA profile match, and that's the end of it. Well,
that's a big concern. That's it.
There are DNA profile matches, and there are DNA profile matches. and they don't all necessarily mean the same thing these days.
Dr. Crane, if I could have you hold on 1 second. Levi Page is being awfully quiet. Levi, do you have any questions? I just wanted to jump in here really quickly and see if you had any. Levi?
Hi, Trisha. Yes, I do.
Okay.
You know, what I have a problem with is touch DNA, understanding how is it different from the DNA that we hear about on a regular basis, because when I watch trials and I see these experts, you know, testify, you know, I go out, glaze over. It's kind of boring. It's really technical. How is it different from the DNA that we're used to? And how long has touch DNA been around?
Well, low copy number and low template DNA is something that the Forensic Science Service in the United Kingdom was starting to use back at the very beginning of the 2000s, 2001, 2002. Those approaches are the hallmark of low copy number or low template DNA testing. It's defined by the amount of starting material that you get to generate your DNA profile with. I've suggested 100 cells is sufficient. That works out to almost a nanogram of DNA. When you're starting to use less than a fifth of a nanogram of DNA, pretty much everybody says we're in a dangerous area and we're in a place where the testing results can be very misleading. Touch DNA, in some sense, kind of straddles what's going on here. Sometimes people will say they've done touch DNA because they're talking about using very small quantities of DNA, less than a fifth of a nanogram. Sometimes they'll say they're using touch DNA, though, with a sample where they've gotten a nanogram or more of DNA, enough where you should be able to get a reliable result. But they call it touch DNA because of the method that they've used to get the DNA from a sample. They go to greater lengths of scraping and things like that to get DNA in a place where they can do some tests on it. So touch DNA is kind of fuzzy for everybody. The core issue is, how much DNA did you have? Did you have enough to get a reliable result? And that typically means a nanogram or more. Or did you have less than a nanogram, and sometimes very much less than a nanogram, such that we have to start worrying very seriously about how reliable the test results are?
Okay. Cynic, I'm going to turn it back over to you, since you're the one with the questions. Go for it, my dear.
One method of transfer that we haven't touched on so far is airborne transfer. And that, of course, relates to coughing, sneezing, or simply the act of speaking. The simple act of speech can and has been proven to transfer DNA, correct?
Exactly, yes.
Okay. Good and bad shedders. Something relating to a little bit to the forms of transfer, primary, secondary, and so on. It has also been proven that if I were to shake your hand and then I were to touch a doorknob, that they would only find your DNA because you are an extremely good shedder of DNA. In other words, you've got a lot of ready-to-go cells at the tips of your fingers. So when you shake my hand, you deposit a great deal of DNA in my hand. Then I take my hand and I touch a surface. And it's one of those inexplicable things of DNA is they don't find my DNA or find so little that it doesn't show up in an electropherogram, but instead they find a good portion of your DNA. Is that correct?
Well, let me just say before I agree with you that that's hypothetical. We don't know your shedder status or my shedder status.
True.
Some people shed DNA readily, other people do not. And in fact, one's shedder status seems to change over the course of time, even during the course of a day. I have some friends and colleagues who think that what determines your shedder status is simply when's the last time that you touched your mouth or picked your nose. But when's the last time you touched your mouth relative to the last time that you've washed your hands? Saliva is a very good source of DNA, and that in and of itself could determine one's shedder status. So if, hypothetically, I've touched my mouth since I've last washed my hands, but you've just freshly washed your hands, when we shake hands, I may be a good shedder and you are not. And then when you touch the doorknob, all that we're going to see is the DNA that you had picked up from me.
And that makes DNA all that much scarier, doesn't it?
What? It brings us back to that axiom, doesn't it?
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah.
Previous people have already touched on this, but in terms of terminology, LCN DNA, low template DNA, as you mentioned, touch DNA, trace DNA, do you have a preference of those terms, like in terms of sort of being more a term that doesn't sort of lend an impression to somebody? I know a lot of people in circles involved in testing of DNA seem to prefer trace DNA. Is that your preference, or do you have any comments about that?
You know, maybe I'm the one who's a cynic at this point, because I'm thinking that all of these terms that we're talking about here, there's an element of marketing that's associated with all of them, and there are proponents who would really like to see their particular version hold sway and get a larger market share. From my perspective, I'm coming at this, I intend at least, from a very just pure scientific perspective. I don't care what we call it. It really doesn't matter to me one way or the other. The central issue here is how much DNA is present in the sample when we start the analysis. And the answer to that question turns out to be the only thing that my opinion is going to hinge upon. If we're talking about 1 nanogram or more of DNA, I'm expecting we're going to get a very reliable DNA profile from the sample that's being tested. If you're talking about 1/5 of that or less, I'm starting to be very concerned about the reliability of the test. And in between, well, nobody has shown just yet where to draw the line and say that we're safe. It's kind of a gray area. By 1 nanogram, we're pretty comfortable. Less than 1/5 of a nanogram, it's potentially very worrisome.
In terms of, I know you mentioned marketing, and I'm going to kind of jump ahead here. I was going to ask this a little later on, but I'll mention it now. Bode Technology, who became somewhat, a lab that became somewhat famous because they did some testing with respect to the JonBenet case in the year 2008, they used, and they described the technique, or at least one of the techniques, as razor scraping. And they claimed that when they razor scraped the long johns that JonBenet was wearing, that they obtained a DNA profile which matched a profile that was already uploaded to the FBI database called CODIS. It turns out that those particular profiles that they obtained that way were weaker than the CODIS profile, which was in itself partial. But can you comment on that? And the reason I mention this is that they made very certain that in their press releases and some of the media tours that some of the techs were on, they always mention that this is not LCN DNA. We process this DNA in the normal or conventional fashion, and that was sort of became their claim to fame. Can you comment on that?
Well, maybe right out of the gate, let's make sure that everybody appreciates that razor scraping isn't any more technologically sophisticated than you might imagine.
It's just a razor and you scrape it, right.
Exactly. So this is not some sort of very clever technological breakthrough that is the basis of this approach. It's just a little bit more aggressive means of trying to get any stray bits of material that might be associated, in this case, with a fabric. And then, once we've got that out of the way, the issue in my mind really just comes down to, well, how much DNA are we talking about? Is it enough to get a reliable profile from, or is it not? And if it's less than 1/5 of a nanogram, I'm starting to worry that this is probably better described as low copy number, or a low template might be a better term. If it's more than a nanogram, then what they're saying suggests that it might be, and that they didn't do any extra steps to really enhance the amplification of the DNA, then maybe it's not as worrisome.
It could just easily be simply a marketing term, and without seeing the reports, the DNA reports, or seeing the electropherogram, you really have no way of sort of intelligently commenting on it, unfortunately.
Right.
But it could just as easily be simply marketing. With respect to getting a full profile from a crime scene sample, there are a lot of things that come into play, degradation being one of them. What does degradation mean in terms of a crime scene sample, and how does it show up in terms of you know, that graphical output that people look at called an electropherogram?
Correct.
Degradation meaning degraded sample, correct?
Correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well, not long ago I told you that you can get a DNA profile off of mail bags that have blood on them 100 years old or more. Well, now I'm going to turn around on that a little bit and say that DNA is a chemical, ultimately, and like all chemicals, it can interact with other chemicals and sometimes comes out the worse for the wear as a result of those interactions. And DNA can be degraded. It can be lost through exposures to the environment. The things that really do a number on DNA, if you pardon my use of the scientific vernacular there, the things that really do a number on DNA are the sorts of things that promote bacterial or fungal growth. And the main things that are causing problems to DNA is other things eat it. They see it as a free lunch. And so warm, moist conditions that facilitate bacterial or fungal growth, those sorts of things tend to cause DNA to be compromised, to be degraded. And sometimes it's an inexact science here. Sometimes the degradation can happen quickly in the matter of a few hours. Sometimes it can play out over the course of weeks or months or years. One other thing that isn't necessarily biological in terms of the cause of the problem is ultraviolet light. So exposure to sunlight or even the ultraviolet light that comes from fluorescent light bulbs, that also can cause damage to DNA. It's ultimately the same reason that we get sunburns, is we're getting damage to our DNA from ultraviolet light and our bodies are repairing it by bringing extra blood to the surface where the damage has occurred. But if a DNA sample is kept in a dry, cold, dark environment, it can persist literally for tens of thousands of years. DNA profiles have been generated off of woolly mammoths and off of mummies that have been dead for thousands of years.
May I jump in here for just a moment, please? I'm getting some questions via text here that I'd kind of like to ask, and I apologize, Cynic, if I'm throwing you off course here. But Dr. Crane, can I ask you about a couple of specific cases where some of this DNA came into play? Would that be okay? Can we talk about specifics here?
Sure.
Okay. A general question I want to ask you. What is the strangest way that you've seen DNA used in a case? By that I mean, where you just DNA was brought in and you just weren't expecting it. What can you give us any weird samples like that?
Well, I'll tell you one of the things. One of the neat side benefits of being an international DNA profiling expert is you get a heck of a lot of good war stories.
We love war stories.
Yeah.
That's what we love here. Let's hear them.
Well, so here at Forensic Bioinformatics, we've been looking at many hundreds and sometimes thousands of cases from around the world every year. And so there's some real doozies. I gave you a Latin lesson a little bit ago. Let me toss in a little more vocabulary for you here. Eskimos have some very large number of words that they use to describe snow, something like 50 or 55 different words to describe different nuances with snow. You and I say fluffy snow or not fluffy snow, and they have these nuances. DNA profiling experts over time start to find that they have certain types of test results that happen time and time again, and it's just convenient for them to talk about them with a new word. So one of the more interesting words that you'll hear DNA experts talk about is liquor DNA. Not like alcohol liquor, but rather somebody having licked another person. It seems like at least one out of 20 cases that we'll see involves liquor DNA, where somebody did transferred their DNA through the process of licking another individual. I've seen DNA evidence that has had a profound impact on society as a result of tests that were performed on a blue dress after it had been dry cleaned. Does that ring a bell?
Well, there you go. Oh, yeah. Good old Monica.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's happened. And, you know, I've also seen DNA testing from the D.C. sniper shootings, where the FBI was generating DNA profiles off of the handheld telephones near where they thought the snipers were, payphones, near where they thought the snipers had taken their shots from, as well as shell casings that were left behind at the shooting scenes. And in those cases, the shell casings gave some very clear DNA profiles that ultimately ended up playing an important role in securing some convictions for those D.C. sniping shootings. The big trial out of the United Kingdom involved, that I alluded to before, where low copy number DNA testing was involved, they were getting DNA off of fragments left over from exploded bombs that had been detonated by the IRA.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, it all just keeps coming back to if an individual touches something, there's at least the potential that we'll be able to get DNA off of it.
This is what scares me, though, Doctor. And Levi Page, you've been kind of quiet. Do you have a question or a comment before I continue on?
No, I'm just listening. Oh. This is very interesting.
Listening and learning. Here's what scares me to death, Dr. Crane, and I've talked to Cynic about this before. Because jurors expect DNA, the prosecution can serve them up DNA, but the DNA may have absolutely nothing to do with the case. And therefore, you either get a false conviction or you raise what you think is, or what they think is, reasonable doubt, and a guilty man walks free because of this DNA. Don't you see that as a real problem here?
Well, it certainly has potential to be a problem. And again, I think we all have to work really hard to make sure that people understand exactly what these DNA test results mean. And I think we have to work really hard to make sure that people do not oversell the value of these DNA test results, and that the labs are held to very high standards in terms of being meticulous and careful with how they're explaining their findings. You asked a moment ago about strange cases or strange evidence samples. There's one that I, to this day, really, it sort of sticks in my craw, is one where I don't think things played out the way they should have played out out of the state of Michigan. It was a cold case. An individual, a woman, had been murdered, and 20-some years later, DNA tests were performed on evidence that was collected at the time of the murder. There were some stains found on her pantyhose and a blood stain found on her hand, and DNA profiles were generated from both of those articles of evidence and submitted against and looked against the Michigan State Offender Database, and both of those samples gave hits to two different individuals. The blood stain on the hand turns out to have come from an individual who was in jail because they had bludgeoned their mother to death. That's they're a murderer, they're in the database for that reason. But it happens that that individual would have had to have been 4 years old at the time of the murder.
I remember reading about this. Right.
And the other individual was in the Michigan database because he had been convicted, I believe it was, of forging some prescriptions for pain medications. He was addicted to pain medications at some point. But he was a pharmaceutical representative who could have had within his sales territory where the murder occurred at that time, 20-some years prior. And so the prosecution ended up coming in and saying that that fellow who contributed to the stain on the pantyhose, he's serving a life prison sentence right now. And the prosecution dismissed the finding of the cold hits to the bloodstain as saying that it was most likely due, and it's hard to say this without snickering a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but he felt it was most likely due to the fact that this woman must have encountered this 4-year-old boy sometime shortly before her death, and she rendered assistance to him when he had something like a nosebleed, despite the fact that the boy, the 4-year-old boy, would have been living 100 miles away in a ghetto.
Oh, that's so ridiculous. That is so ridiculous.
And from the defendant's perspective, it would have played out so much better if that 4-year-old boy hadn't had his DNA in the database, because then mm-hmm. that would have given rise to reasonable doubt, right? They could
right.
have beat their chest in front of the jury saying that, look, here's your real murderer. He left blood there. We don't know mm-hmm. how this guy's DNA got under her pantyhose, but there's your real murderer. But because they brought up this hypothetical nosebleed, it all played out. I've got to tell you, in the context of this story, the question then becomes, well, then how did both of their DNAs get on these samples?
Yes.
You've got a lot of sleuths listening here, right? So let me
mm-hmm.
spin this out with some clues. I think it is telling and curious and important that the victim's DNA wasn't found with either of those two samples, either her pantyhose sample or the blood stain on the hand. Her DNA wasn't there. It was just these guys neat all by themselves. And I think it's also pretty curious that the cold case was being processed across the hall from the lab where both of those individuals' DNA was being processed to be entered into the Michigan State database at about the
plant.
Same time. Not necessarily plant. That implies nefarious...
accidental transfer.
Right. Contamination.
Contamination.
I think that's the simplest explanation for the results as we're seeing. And that's what was presented by the defense to the jury, and yet they came back and... to a man, he's been found guilty and is serving time in a Michigan State Penitentiary.
And that, to me, is a case of DNA that perhaps was used incorrectly to convict what very well could be an innocent man. Dr. Crane, we're almost out of time, so I'm going to turn it back over to Cynic, because I know Cynic has some more questions. Cynic, wrap it up, my dear. Bring us home.
Well, it's still going to be a few minutes, unfortunately. I would have liked to have had a little bit of a more of a lead up to this, but I'm going to throw some terms in here that hopefully Dr. Crane can just deal with as I wrap this up. I cannot let you go, Dr. Crane, without your thoughts regarding the DNA evidence in the JonBenét case. And I know that when we spoke and when we emailed one another, you made some interesting comments that I feel need to be said. So. I'm going to just give people a real quick lead in here, and then I'll let you take it away. And I don't want to get into the minutiae of the DNA case, primarily because I don't have the time, but I would like to focus on the DNA evidence that's been in the mainstream media for many years with respect to the JonBenét case. One area in the crotch of JonBenét's underpants that was tested revealed a profile that was ultimately uploaded to the FBI database, CODIS. JonBenét was the major donor by virtue of contributing blood, and there was an unknown minor male profile from unknown cellular material. That minor unknown male profile was a mixed profile with dropout, because only 10 out of 13 loci were found. In 2008, the long johns, which were worn over top of the underpants, were sent to the private lab, Bodie, as I've already touched on before, and they did the razor scraping and so on. And it was publicly revealed that the testing resulted in DNA profiles which, while weaker than the CODIS profile, were considered to match. So we know that these profiles were 9 loci or less. There are, of course, a number of transfer mechanisms between two articles of clothing, one worn tightly over the other. It could have been transfer based on that. It could have been something happened, for example, at the autopsy. Perhaps proper safeguards weren't in place. Things were touched, even with gloves. It doesn't matter if you're touching certain evidentiary items and you're touching others without changing your gloves. It's possible that could be a source of the contamination. Even the coroner or the medical examiner handling instruments that weren't properly cleaned could have transferred from previous autopsies, and so on. There's just a number of ways, as we touched on throughout this broadcast, in terms of transferring DNA evidence. I would like to focus, however, on the fact that this was a mixed sample with dropout. And by dropout, I mean we don't have information at all of the loci. CODIS, for example, if I were to take a swab, a cheek swab, and I sent it to the lab, I would have all 13 of the CODIS loci light up, and there would be a full profile. These are partial profiles, also mixed, or at least we know for a fact that the blood spot was mixed because it primarily had JonBenet's blood. You've made the statement, and it's one that actually I've never heard before. You told me that there is no generally accepted means of attaching a reliable statistical weight to a mixed DNA profile where allelic dropout may have occurred. And you then went on to tell me that essentially what this means is that, in your opinion, from the evidence that I sent you, that this DNA evidence really could not be presented in court. Could you comment?
Yeah, I'm sad that you hadn't heard that before, because that means we're not doing a good enough job getting the word out. And again, often a big part of my job when I get involved with a case is educating attorneys and educating juries about things like that, at the present time, there is no generally accepted means of attaching a statistical weight to a mixed DNA profile where dropout might have occurred. In other words, where we're getting partial or incomplete information about one of the contributors. Now, in an unmixed sample, we can deal with dropout, but in a mixed sample, I don't think we have the time for me to explain to you the underlying reasoning behind it, but it's just not possible for us at the present time. And it's not for lack of trying. Many individuals in the Forensic Science Service, before it went out of business a few years ago, had invested millions of pounds into solving this problem. There are some people now who are starting to say there might be a way that we can attach weight to those types of samples. But here's what it all comes down to. There is an abundance of case law within the United States that says that if you can't attach a statistical weight to a DNA inclusion, saying that somebody matches an evidence sample, if you can't put a number on that, one in a million, one in a quintillion, something like that, you can't admit it as evidence. It is not something that can be presented to a jury because they simply won't know what weight to give it if you can't attach a reliable statistical weight. So absent a statistical weight, all that really can be said about a mixed sample where dropout might have occurred is that the test results are inconclusive. We simply are in no better position to say if an individual has contributed to the profile or not relative to where we were before the test or after the test was performed. So the samples that you're talking about here, the blood stain and the JonBenet Ramsey case from the crotch of the panties, I think at the end of the day, that's simply not something that could be presented to a jury. Now, it could be used to generate investigative leads. Law enforcement can use Ouija boards to generate investigative leads if they like.
Exactly. There we go.
But it's not something that you could talk about in court.
Dr. Crane?
This is concerning Mary Lacey, our friend, so I would be remiss if I let Dan go without this. A real quick point. We also spoke about this. If the district attorney in this case went from saying in 2006 that DNA could be an artifact, it isn't necessarily the killers, to in 2008 saying unexplained DNA on the victim of a crime is powerful evidence to match with male DNA on two separate items of clothing worn by the victim at the time of the murder makes it clear that an unknown male handled these items. Despite substantial efforts over the years to identify the source of this DNA, there is no innocent explanation for its incriminating presence at three sites on these two different items of clothing that JonBenet was wearing at the time of the murder. When you and I talked, I just asked you as a hypothetical, if a district attorney is for example, exonerating people that were suspects for many years based exclusively on the DNA that we've just discussed here, is that an overreach? I'll just let it go at that. Is that an overreach?
Well, let me draw particular attention to the word exclusively, right? If that is the sole basis for the decision, I think that that conveys a lack of understanding of what's involved with those types of DNA test results.
Thank you. Perfect.
Thank you,
oh, keep going. I'm sorry. No, keep going. I just wanted to hear that. That's exactly what we wanted to hear. But please continue and we'll wrap it up.
Well, I don't know that there's too much more to say. It's an overreach in the sense that, again, we're talking here about something that couldn't be presented to a jury, and it's an overreach because it seems to be violating, or it has the potential to violate, that axiom that I began with, that the presence of a DNA profile doesn't necessarily say anything about the time frame or the circumstances. We can't say if it got there because it was deposited during the commission of a crime. We can't say if it got there because the laundry had been done in a way that got somebody else's DNA there, or could have come there through contamination after the evidence had been collected and handled in the lab. There are so many different ways that the DNA could have gotten there that by itself, those deep partial profiles, that's not something that we should be attaching that kind of weight to.
Dr. Crane, this has been a fascinating hour. I know you're extremely busy, and I appreciate you so much for taking the time out to explain to us sleuths here the complex issues surrounding DNA and making it understandable to us. Thank you so much. You can find out more about Dr. Crane at www.bioforensics.com. Dr. Crane, thanks again.
It's been my pleasure.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye.
Okay, we are going to switch topics right now, and we are going to talk about a possible serial killer. This guy has got everybody's attention. His name is Randy Allen Taylor, and Randy Taylor is the last person to have contact with Samantha Clark, a 19-year-old who disappeared 3 years ago. And he has been arrested in the disappearance of Alexis Murphy, last seen August 3rd. With us on the phone now is Chris Stover. Chris is the anchor reporter. He has many jobs here for WCAV, WVAW, and WAHU. And Chris, welcome to Trisha's True Crime Radio.
Hi, Trisha. Thanks for having me.
Okay, can you give us a background on this character? What do you know about him? What is his life story, if you can, in a capsule for us?
Well, Randy Taylor, he's 48 years old. He's lived in the Charlottesville area for at least a couple decades. And he's basically held a few odd jobs recently. He has a bit of a criminal history. In the 90s, he spent a few years in jail for being an accessory to burglary. In the early to mid-2000s, he was also convicted of arson, but he had a suspended sentence there. And so basically all he had to do was pay some court fines. And as you said, he was considered, I guess, a person of interest in 2010 with the disappearance of Samantha Ann Clark in Orange County, which is about 30 miles or 20 to 30 miles north of Charlottesville. And then, of course, he's now arrested, charged with abduction in the case of Alexis Murphy. That's in Lovingston, which is about 30 miles south of Charlottesville. He lives, his house is on Route 29, which is basically a thruway through central Virginia. And his house is not that far from where Alexis Murphy was last seen on the night of August 3rd, not far from that gas station many people have been talking about.
Go
ahead.
Please continue. No, I was going to say the gas station, they have footage of Alexis and then Randy in at the same time. Is that correct?
That's what authorities have said. They haven't released those pictures. They haven't released any video. What we have seen are the pictures of Alexis. But that is what a lot of people are led to believe, because he is charged with abduction and Alexis Murphy is still missing. So there has to be some evidence that prosecutors have to have him on this charge.
Now, his defense lawyer, Michael Hallahan, told media outlets that Murphy, Alexis Murphy, was at Taylor's camper with another man the night she disappeared.
Right.
And he said that Taylor bought marijuana from the man. Is there any evidence to suggest that Alexis was doing anything like this? Or is this, I know you can't offer opinion, but I can. Is this just a made-up story by a defense attorney?
It's really interesting. Obviously that's what the attorney said, I believe it was on Wednesday. And the backstory is that Alexis had an encounter with Randy Taylor a couple weeks before she went missing at the car wash where Randy Taylor worked, and they were talking about smoking marijuana. Then they encountered each other again, apparently, on August 3rd, and then that's where the story from his defense attorney came, saying that Randy Taylor asked Alexis if she knew someone who could give him some marijuana. And then they met at Randy Taylor's house, which, again, is only a couple miles north of the gas station where they were talking. And then, according to the lawyer, both Alexis and the man who has not been identified yet left. The family of Alexis Murphy has said that not once have they ever even thought that Alexis was involved with drugs and ever smoked marijuana. They say that they never really saw any signs of her having smoked pot, but they do say, though, that, you know, just as they've gotten their story out there, Randy Taylor deserves an opportunity to put his story out there.
I'm going to go to Levi Page. Levi Page, Chris, is one of our amazing bloggers and general all-around great guy when it comes to true crime. Levi, what do you know about this story and Randy Taylor? Is there anything that we're missing here?
Well, you know, what's so weird to me is that we see a lot of defendants or suspects in cases that always throw around, you know, I'm not guilty. Look at this black guy. This black guy is the one that did. Remember Susan Smith in Texas that killed her two children? She blamed it on a black guy to try to deflect off of her. And this attorney, it's so weird. He's doing a lot of talking. Not only has he said that this is a black guy that did this, he describes him as someone with cornrows in his mid to late 20s, describes the car that this person was driving. Obviously, he's getting this information from his client, Randy Taylor. And another thing that's interesting to me is that Randy Taylor says that he met Alexis at the gas station and they just struck up a conversation about weed. And that's weird to me because Alexis has been described by people that knew her, by her family, as, quote, a girly girl. And if you look at this Randy Taylor, this 48-year-old man, this does not seem to be the type of person that she would willingly strike up a conversation with. This guy looks a little creepy, and I doubt that she would just walk up to him and just start a conversation with him about weed. So I think that his story is very suspect, and I think right now what law enforcement is doing with this kidnapping charge, this abduction charge, rather, is if this child's alive, he's going to tell where she's at. He's going to tell where the 17-year-old girl's at. He's going to stay in prison when she's alive. Hey, she's here. If she's dead, if he did something to her that caused her death, he's going to be quiet, or he's going to lie, or he's going to make things up to try to throw attention off of himself. And to me, as an outsider looking in, that's what he's doing, making up this story of a black guy with cornrows, and then his attorneys going out in the media and passing along this information. I think his attorney also said that Alexis went to his home with this black guy, and they smoked and drank. And again, if she's described as a girly girl, she's involved in volleyball, this does not seem the type of people that she would hang out with. And this guy, Randy Taylor, from what I've read, was a frequent shopper at an adult store.
Yeah.
Which shows you what kind of person he is. He's a pervert.
Mm-hmm. And I also have a question. Yes.
I also have a question. A lot of people have speculated that Randy Taylor may be the, quote, 29 stalker. What is the Route 29 stalker? And some people say that he's not linked to that, but there's a lot of speculation regarding that.
I honestly, myself, don't have too much background on the Route 29 stalker. That was well before my time in Charlottesville. That was, I believe, in the 80s and into the 90s. There has been some speculation. There was a case, Alicia Showalter Reynolds. She was coming into town from, I believe it was Baltimore, and she was pulled over by a guy who said that she had a taillight out or something, wrong with her car. And that was up in Culpeper, which is about an hour north of Charlottesville on Route 29. And that was the last anyone had seen her. And that was in the mid-90s, and that's still a cold case today. The descriptions that have been in that case don't really match the description of Randy Taylor. I mean, and that's mostly just the ages don't match up that well. I mean, maybe you could make an argument that the physical description adds up better than the age description. But the Samantha Clark case out of Orange County in 2010 is more where he's connected.
And how is he connected to Samantha Clark, Chris?
Well, he appears to be a social media, very social media savvy. And this didn't really come out until a couple of years after Samantha went missing. But he was said to have had contact with Samantha Clark on the night she disappeared via Facebook. That's basically as much information about that that's come out. There was a separate case where he basically filed a suit against a local sheriff's office for illegally putting a GPS tracker on the back of his car. So basically all evidence that they might have gotten from that had to be thrown out because there was never a warrant issue. He never knew about it. He found it one time himself. And then he came forward with that. The details of the settlement never released, but he was very vocal about that. He actually went to a local newspaper and gave them the story about all this. And that's really when we learned about his involvement with Samantha Clark.
Interesting. Michael in Minnesota. Michael is my unofficial co-host, and Michael's been reading up on the case. Do you have any questions, Michael, or should I continue?
Go ahead and continue. I do have questions, but I'd like to see how this all plays out.
Oh, got it. Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're talking with Chris Stover. Chris is an anchor reporter for WCAV, WVAW, and WAHU, and he's been so gracious to give us his time. I know you have to go on the air in a little bit, so we're going to keep it a little bit short with you tonight, but we like the background here. One thing that we try and do on Trisha's True Crime Radio is find out why. What happens to people as kids where they grow up and turn into whatever perhaps he has turned into? Do you know anything about his early background? Was he in trouble with the law as a juvenile? Do we know anything about his early life, Chris?
It's been really hard from our standpoint to track that. I mentioned the earlier, about 20 years ago, he was involved in some burglaries and things like that. I mean, he's been someone who might have spent a lot of time in jail, but not really in prison for some pretty serious things. As we've been trying to research more on Randy Taylor, we found that the FBI, who's been involved in this case for a search for Alexis Murphy, has basically given they've made confidentiality agreements with a lot of people. For example, the place where he last worked, which was a used car dealership up in Greene County, they were told by the FBI not to talk. I did talk to one person who knew him on a somewhat personal level, who knew about his criminal background, who said that they're shocked that he could be accused of a crime like this. She said that her daughter, her teenage daughter, was in the same bedroom with him. He was delivering supplies to their house, and they were in the bedroom just about a week and a half before Alexis Murphy disappeared. And she said nothing ever happened there. There was no fears in the mom's eyes about that. And they're convinced that there just has to be a mistake, that they're hoping this is a big mishap, because they're painting a completely different picture than what many people in the media have been portraying and what the prosecutors are portraying. They're saying that this man, it's just too shocking to believe that he might actually be involved in something like this.
Supposedly, according to one of our members in chat room, law enforcement put a tracking device on his car without a warrant, and it had to be thrown out. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was the case up in Greene County back in – it happened after Samantha – that was related to the Samantha Clark case.
Okay.
Samantha Clark went missing in Orange for at least a year. They were searching a lake in Greene County. All police would say at the time, and even to this day, was that they're searching that lake in this for the Samantha Clark case, but they would not say why they were at that lake or exactly what they were looking for. But it's the Greene County, the lake is in Greene County, and the sheriff's office there is the one that he brought that suit against, which required all that evidence that they may have gotten to be thrown out.
Tell us about the suit again. I may have missed that part.
That was just where he found the device, the GPS device, and it was near his license plate in the rear of his car. He found it when he was, I believe, cleaning his car one day, and from there just, hired a lawyer, brought it to their attention, and then brought the suit against the Greene County Sheriff's Office.
Got it. Okay. Is Taylor a known drug user or drug dealer? You've talked about pot. Is there anything stronger that we know of?
His criminal records don't show many drug convictions or drug arrests. It was just, again, the accessory to burglary in the 90s and then the arson and a few other things. But recently he has basically just paid a lot of court fines rather than any jail time for that.
And he's been accused of stalking, if I'm not mistaken, brandishing a firearm. I mean, he doesn't sound like a real... I wouldn't be thrilled if my daughter brought him home. Let me put it that way. Is there any meat to those charges at all?
Well, talking to some people who knew him, I mean, they basically say that everybody deserves a second chance, and that's why that's why he's held these random jobs, maybe not for that long. When I talked to the car dealership, they confirmed that he worked there, but did not confirm when he left or why he left. He no longer works there, but he did work there recently. But, as I said before, it appears that he's more, based on his past records, more of a minor criminal than someone who would be implicated in abductions or homicides or things like that.
Got it. Chris, I know you have to leave in just a few moments. So, Michael, did you have some questions that you would like to ask Chris?
I do. I saw in one of the newscasts where they had surrounded his house and had all these people searching the premises and the domicile, and he's been arrested. I'm wondering, on what evidence have they arrested him? That piece is lacking to me.
That's been lacking for a lot of us as well. He's charged with abduction, and we don't know why. They held a press conference last Monday. He was arrested a week ago tonight. They held a press conference the following day where they didn't take any questions. They just basically issued statements and said that he was abducted or that he abducted her. But that's all they would give. And at the time, of course, his lawyer was appointed at his court hearing the next day, which was Tuesday. And by Wednesday, he had another lawyer because the original lawyer cited a conflict of interest. So he has a new bond hearing scheduled for this coming Thursday. And at that hearing, they're going to request bond again since he's been denied already. But now that he has a court-appointed lawyer, they can go through that process again. And what the expectation is that the prosecution will have to present some type of evidence that they have to suggest probable cause in his arrest. So Thursday could be the day where we see the first glimmer of evidence in this. We do know that they took his It was a late model GMC Suburban. They took that from his property. They took a camper from his property. But otherwise, authorities have been very tight-lipped about exactly what's linking him to Alexis Murphy and why this is just an abduction charge. I mean, again, for now, Alexis could still be out there. We don't know the status of Alexis. She is still considered missing and still considered endangered.
This just doesn't make sense to me because they arrested him before they even started the search of the Suburban and the trailer. Aren't I correct? Isn't that the right timeline?
Well, the FBI last Sunday began zeroing in on him and his property. It was the next day where the SUV and the camper were taken. There's just a lot of speculation based on the series of events. There, you know, Alexis Murphy's car was found in Charlottesville, which again is 30 miles north of Lovingston, where she went missing, and that's also the place where, again, speculation that Randy Taylor was at the adult store, which is just a few miles from where the car was found. So whether the FBI did stop by that store, again, not telling media much of anything about what they were doing there, why they were there, or even what they were asking, what they were showing employees at that store. But they do link him there the night that Alexis Murphy disappeared. Her car was found a couple days after that.
I'm just really worrying that there's been a rush to judgment here on this guy. It seems like they would have been better off keeping quiet and building a case before they made the arrest and made the accusations, and now everyone thinks he's some kind of creep. Going to a dirty bookstore does not a criminal make. I mean,
there are a few points to that. Even at the press conference, they continue to ask the public to call in the tip line with any information, whether it was just general information, whether anyone had seen his Suburban around town. I mean, it's a pretty distinct Suburban. It has a camouflage design running along the side, and lots of people in Nelson County, which is a very small community where Lovingston is, many people there have said that they've seen him around, don't really know him necessarily, but they've seen him around. But then also, so he was arrested in mid-August. His preliminary hearing isn't until January, until the beginning of January, which is unusual for someone to be arrested and then have to wait that long for a preliminary hearing. So the thought behind that is that it's giving prosecutors some additional time to gather evidence to perhaps charge him with any possible related crimes that could come out of this, have evidence that they acquire between now and January to supersede the evidence that they have right now. So, again, I mean, they have to have some sort of probable cause to have him arrested on this charge. What they might have on him still remains a mystery, and we might see that come out, or at least some of that come out on Thursday.
Well, doesn't it? Don't they have to give him a reason that he's being held? They have to show their hands to some extent, don't they?
They do to him, but not necessarily to the public. And so if the prosecutors want to keep him in jail and prevent him from being out on bail or bond, then they're going to have to make an argument to the judge in a public courtroom some little nugget of information that they have that can convince the judge that, yes, he should stay behind bars until his preliminary hearing in January.
Chris, I know you have to leave. I just want to ask you one final question, if I could. This is from the chat room from Scorekeeper. Do we know if Randy Allen Taylor, is he mentally challenged in any way? I know he's good on Facebook and social media, but I know people who are extremely mentally challenged who can handle that as well. Do we know anything about his IQ level?
We don't. There hasn't been any indication about that. I mean, in his initial court appearance, which was on Tuesday, he didn't say much. He basically answered questions from the judge with either a yes or a no. He did, when the judge mentioned Alexis's name, he did let out a pretty big sigh. He kept kind of eyeing up the camera a little bit. There was a camera in the courtroom, and he would just occasionally look to see if the camera was on and mm-hmm. whether it was on him. So, I mean, that's really all we've seen of Randy Taylor since his arrest. So I think it's too early to determine any of that. And I'm sure if that is the case, you know, he'll have to see whether he's competent to stand trial should it get that far. So
there you go.
I'm sure all that kind of stuff could come out in the coming weeks.
Chris Stover, anchor reporter for WCAV, WVAW, and WAHU. Go to facebook.com/StoverReporter. Chris, whether you like it or not, you're going to be our go-to guy for facts and details of this case. We've just anointed you that. So I hope you'll come back with us very soon, okay?
Great. I appreciate you having me.
Thanks, Chris. Take care. Levi Page, I know you're still with us, right?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. What are your
part
thoughts?
Part of what I think that they may have against him is, according to reports that I've read, inside of Randy Taylor's home there was cell phones, multiple cell phones. They haven't mm-hmm. specified whose cell phones it was, but if one of the cell phones belonged to Alexis Murphy, then that tells us something, because normally a 17-year-old, they always have their cell phone by their
sure.
side, and I doubt that she was going to leave her cell phone at this man's place. According to this guy, Randy Taylor, she was not smoking weed at his house, and she was not drunk at his house, which means that she would be in a position not to leave her cell phone there. She would be thinking clearly. So why was her cell phone left at his home if it was? That speaks volumes. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think the fact that this guy visited adult stores is weird, because, you know, in this day and age, you don't really have to visit stores to look at porn. That's something that old, creepy men do. And I remember back in the Holly Vogel case, which the girl, teenager that vanished
mm-hmm.
in my home state of Tennessee, where she lived, there was a lot of porn, not porn places, but adult stores, and a lot of, it was near an interstate, so a lot of freaks could have abducted her. That was one of the things that people speculated about. So if you have a guy that's visiting adult stores that has a history of stalking and brandishing firearms and is striking out conversations with 17-year-old girls at gas stations, that looks very suspect to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it could, you know, they've got to have something on him. They absolutely do. And
well, her hair. Well, I know we just did a big thing about DNA.
The hair,
we just
right.
did a big thing about DNA, but her hair was there. So they do know that she was in his place. And does it make sense, if we use our common sense, that she would voluntarily go to this guy's place? This guy is a 48-year-old man, and he looks creepy. He does not look like someone that this 17-year-old attractive girl who plays volleyball would voluntarily go visit him. So I think that they have a lot more that we don't know about.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. But the thing that concerns me is the case in 2010. Obviously, they had some information against him based on that GPS, and he was able to get it thrown out of court. It's kind of like, you know, it's like, okay, once maybe, yeah, but twice, no. There's two girls missing, and he both has some kind of weird connection to him. To me, that's just, that to me speaks, is what speaks volumes to this.
I mean, if you're so linked to all of these missing teens, I mean, Trisha, you've never been accused of being involved in the disappearance of two separate missing
no.
girls. Neither have I. It's fishy. I think, you know, the saying goes, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I
mm-hmm.
think the guy even admitted, Randy Allen Taylor admitted when he was pulled over during that traffic stop with that other missing girl that he was in communication with her.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, no teenage girl want to have contact with this guy. Let me tell you that.
Right.
So
he
why is he
creepy.
In contact with all these teenagers that he's not related with?
Yeah, it's very, very strange. Michael, I'm going to let you kind of have the last word here. What are your thoughts after listening to Levi and myself?
Well, I just never want to rush to judgment. I did it on the Zimmerman case. I told you I wanted to keep an open mind from the very beginning. And until I understand more about this, I'm not ready to convict this Randy Taylor. There was the case, he was questioned or a suspect in a case, and here he was in jail at the time that the case he was being looked at for as a suspect. He couldn't have done it. He was in jail somewhere else. So
right, that's a different case, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
But still, I think once you're on the radar, the police tend to focus on you, and I've never been on a police radar, so I'm not speaking from personal experience, but I certainly have been to adult bookstores in my life, and I'm mm-hmm. certainly not some kind of freak of nature. So I don't know. For some reason, I just am not willing to convict him yet.
Well, I don't think any of us
there's a difference between enough to arrest and enough to convict. Those are entirely different. And what I think they're doing is this is a homicide case. Let's just
right.
be blunt here. A 17-year-old is missing for this long, the chances are that she's no longer with us, and that's extremely sad. I hate to say it, but that's what
I know. And she's a beautiful.
And I think that they're charging him with abduction to see what they can get out of him. It's
mm-hmm.
ultimately what I think they're going for is homicide. This is just the beginning, I think. And I think what they're doing.
These tactics have backfired, though, in the other cases we've seen, as far as Haley Cummings, Casey Anthony. You can sweat someone out, but that doesn't necessarily mean they've
well,
done anything. They had Andrea Schneiderman. They had Andrea Schneiderman on arrested and home lockdown, and then they ended up dropping the most serious charges against
yeah,
her.
Yeah, I think they should have went ahead. I think they should have went ahead and went with murder charges on Andrea Schneiderman, but that's an entire different story.
Yeah,
but,
I agree.
She's an entirely different character. Don't even get me started on her. But in the Haley Cummings case, I think that the police got a bad rap in the beginning for not being tough enough on Ron and Misty. They Ron and Misty, you know, they had the fact that Misty Crossland was a teenager. Ronald was in his mid-20s. That's statutory rape. They were criticized for not immediately going in and arresting him for statutory rape. They were criticized immediately for not charging Misty Crossland with obstruction of justice with all the differing accounts that she told law enforcement. And their reasoning for doing that was they sit back and they wait. And guess what? A statutory rape or an obstruction of justice, how much time are they going to spend behind bars on that? Probably not much. But they got them on drug dealing, and they're serving 15 and 25 years in prison. And they've been in jail since 2010. They haven't said anything yet. However, we have seen people sit in jail for a long time on unrelated charges, and they get in there with other inmates, and they like to brag about what they've done and what they've got away with in the past. And that could happen there. And with this guy, I think that they definitely have more than we know, because normally they want to sit back and watch and wait. But I think that they have some evidence. The cell phone, was it Alexis's cell phone? They have hair in his, I mean, if it's just a small piece of hair, that may not be that big of a deal. But if it's a clump of hair, like it was pulled out in a fight
mm-hmm.
or a struggle, that's different. I mean, it's speculation, but they could have a lot more than what we know of. And I ultimately think they are letting him sweat, because if she's alive, he's going to tell them where she's at if he passed her on to somebody else, because he wants to get out. That will give him a lighter sentence, a lighter charge, versus if he killed her, he's going to keep his mouth shut and he's going to lie. He's going to try to deflect, and he's doing that with this story of this black guy with cornrows that is a drug dealer that he purchased $60 of wheat from.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. You make some excellent points, Levi Page. You really do. Go to LeviPageShow.com. Did I get the address right, Levi?
You did.
Okay, good. LeviPageShow.com. We're going to have you on again real soon, Levi. Thank you very much. It was a long
show. Michael. Yes, it was very good.
Thank you. Thank you, Levi. I really appreciate it. And Michael, my friend, you too bring up some excellent points. It's always good to wait and not rush to judgment. We've rushed to judgment way too many times in too many cases, and it's just not turned out right. But this guy just gives me the creeps. He really does. I look at his picture and I just go, ugh. And I know going to an adult bookstore doesn't mean anything. I understand that. But I just think what Levi said about him talking to those teenage girls, and he's, you know, and you could be right, though, Michael. We'll have to wait and see. This is going to be interesting how it plays out, because he's kind of already been labeled a possible serial killer. So Randy Allen Taylor may be in prison for a long time, or he may be an innocent man. But my thoughts are he's guilty, but we'll have to wait and see. Michael, you're joining us next week, right?
Hopefully.
Hopefully, what do you mean? You better be. You better not make plans. You have no right. No right whatsoever to make plans. Hey, everybody, thank you so much for joining us tonight. I do appreciate it. Do remember that Trisha's True Crime Radio is brought to you by your local No-Kill Network. Go to www.nokillnetwork.org to find your local no-kill shelter. And also remember, opinions expressed on Trisha's True Crime Radio are those of the hosts and guests. And if you hear something on Trisha's True Crime Radio that upsets you, do remember that we are a completely separate entity from WebSleuths.com, LLC, and ForumsForJustice.org. So come to me if you have a problem with the show, and we'll try and make you happy. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio, where we discuss true crime and current events, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everyone.